This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Voters in six states, including Kentucky, went to the polls on Tuesday for primaries to choose candidates for the November midterm elections. The Kentucky U.S. Senate primary between Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Tea Party favorite Matt Bevin got a lot of national attention. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us this hour to analyze the results and talk about other national political headlines. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Ken, it's good to have you with us again.
Great to be here, Jay and Howard.
And as always,
who is this?
Just remember, Howard, I'm not important. And as always, when Ken Rudin joins us, he starts with a trivia question. Hopefully today is not an exception.
It's correct, but it's an easier one than usual. So I have a feeling that Howard will know the answer before I finish answering the question.
So which
and the question is,
can I guess the question? Which team is doing worse, the Yankees or the Reds?
I'm sorry, my line just went dead. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Yes, we don't want to talk about that. But the question is, who was the last Ohioan appointed to the U.S. Senate, and whom did he succeed?
The last Ohioan appointed to the U.S. Senate, and whom did he succeed?
Oh, I got it.
Yep.
Let's see.
I know.
No, he actually did. He's writing down the question. I haven't seen an answer yet.
We'll get it.
Well, if you think there,
guys, by the way, we're not on Skype. I mean, we can't. We don't see what you're doing. I'll just take your word for it.
But he did write down an answer. So Howard does have an answer written down. Okay. If you think you know the answer to that question, 513-419-7100, and we will reward you with a political junkie button. Again, the last Ohioan appointed to the Senate, and whom did he succeed? Well, we had primaries this week, lots of primaries. We're going to talk to start out about the primary in Kentucky. Mitch McConnell taking on Tea Party favorite Matt Bevin. I don't think anybody was surprised that Mitch McConnell came out on top. What was your reflections, Ken, on Tuesday's primary results?
Well, I agree with you. It was not a surprise. He had this opponent, Matt Bevin, the businessman backed by the Tea Party. And yes, the margin was not close. It was 60% something to 36 something. And you could make the case that, well, it really wasn't much of a threat at all. But once upon a time, Matt Bevin represented a serious threat to Mitch McConnell, because clearly Mitch McConnell and the Tea Party have no love lost between them. Mitch McConnell has said that we're going to crush them. He actually said that at the beginning of this election cycle. And look, there's been a lot of enmity between the two sides for a long time, given the fact that many Tea Party candidates in 2010 and 2012 knocked off Republican establishment figures, only to lose the seats in November. You think of Richard Murdoch over Dick Lugar in Indiana. You think of Christine, I am not a witch, O'Donnell in Delaware, who knocked off a favorite Republican. And of course, the Todd Akin thing, which is really not much of a Tea Party thing, but Todd Akin in Missouri. So the Republicans and the Tea Party have been at odds for a couple of cycles, and this time they were prepared. So a lot of incumbents, like Mitch McConnell, have been knew they were put on notice that they were threatened, but this time they were completely prepared, both financially and with opposition research.
And now that it's over, though, I mean, you've got those 36% who voted for Matt Bevin and the people that they listened to in the Tea Party. Mitch McConnell has to kiss and make up with a lot of those people now, doesn't he?
He does, and that's why Rand Paul played an amazing role in this whole thing. The fact is, Rand Paul is the Tea Party darling. Rand Paul was elected to the Senate despite Mitch McConnell's opposition. Mitch McConnell backed, of course, you know, his own personal candidate to succeed Jim Bunning, and it wasn't Rand Paul. And yet Paul stayed away from Bevin. He probably held his nose and said he was going to endorse McConnell. But it helps Rand Paul in several ways. It keeps him in the good graces with the establishment. And assuming Rand Paul is going to run for president in 2016, he has some very grateful people behind him, presumably Mitch McConnell among them.
And I think Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell are having a press conference. I think I saw an email tomorrow to try to talk to the press about going forward through November.
Well, look, you know, McConnell knows that as much, whatever threat that Matt Bevin represented, it doesn't compare to what Alison Lundgren Grimes is going to be in November. She is considered, she's the Secretary of State, she's run statewide, she's considered a strong candidate, she has the United Democratic Party behind her. Now, of course, you can do what Mitch McConnell is attempting to do, but to tie her with President Obama, of course, Grimes will argue that Obama is not on the ballot, and the issue is Mitch McConnell, not Barack Obama. But the state is certainly more conservative when it comes to Senate races. Interestingly, not in gubernatorial races, because usually the governors of Kentucky are Democrats, and I think they've only been two Republicans in the last 60 years. Louis Nunn and Ernie Fletcher are the only Republicans that I could think of in a long, long time. But on the Senate stage, of course, you know, since Wendell Ford retired, there's been no Democrat elected to the Senate there, and McConnell and the Republicans would like to keep it that way.
I thought it was kind of interesting, McConnell right off the bat, and I'm used to political campaigns where challengers issue debate challenges to incumbents, but Mitch McConnell issued a challenge to her to debate, you know, a number of times around the state.
Well, I think the feeling is that she may not be as strong on issues as the Democrats would like, and of course McConnell will always out debate anybody. He's not a warm and fuzzy kind of guy, and he's not personally likable in the sense that he's not. I mean, he's just not a cuddly kind of candidate. But he's cunning and he's smart, and we've seen and throughout all his career since he was first elected in '84 that he knows how to win and will do what it takes to win. But The name of the game is female voters. We see in 2014, and McConnell is very aware of that.
Right.
On the night of his victory party, he had his wife. He talked about his mother. He talked about these three women who were frustrated by Obamacare. And so both McConnell and Grimes will go after women, you know, female voters, and who could clearly make the difference in November.
With the female voters, does Mitch McConnell, I know Howard and I interviewed Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear last summer, and we were talking about the potential McConnell-Grimes race, and I mean, I think Governor Beshear's words running against McConnell was not a pleasant experience.
Yeah.
And he's known to be pretty cutthroat. Does he have to scale that back any since he's running against a female?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and I think the answer to that is yes. And I don't know how my remarks. First of all, I have no idea what I'm about to say, but I know that they're going to be analyzed to death. But remember when Rick Lazio ran against Hillary Clinton for the Senate in New York in 2000, and he went over to her and demanded, you know, some talking points or some agreements on some debates, and everybody felt that he was encroaching on her space. There's a certain way. I remember when Clayton Williams was running against Ann Richards for governor of Texas in 1990, you know, she put out her hand and he refused to shake her hand. There are some things you just don't do. And there's a certain sensitivity that male candidates running against women should understand. And I think McConnell, given the fact that his wife is so prominent and savvy, as is McConnell, I think they won't fall into those pitfalls.
And clearly, he has wasted no time, though, with Matt Bevin. I mean, he quickly had a nickname for him, Bailout Bevins. And I think he also has already had a name for Alison Grimes, which I believe is part-time Grimes, insinuating that she's only Secretary of State part-time candidate the rest of the time.
Yes, and you could also make the case that, you know, it's McConnell who's been, I mean, there's also McConnell overload. I mean, the fact that he's been in the Senate for so long, since 1985, and that he's just been around, and given the fact that there seems to be this mood in the country for a generational change, if not an ideological change, he has to deal with that as well. So nicknames are fun, but somehow you're just going to have to convince voters, and he has a lot of money to do it. The fact is that he won his primary pretty handily, and a lot of Republicans in other states did well as in other states as well on Tuesday as well. So for all the talk about Republican fratricide and family feuds and things like that, for another week, the Republicans look like the establishment did pretty good.
That argument about Mitch McConnell, that, hey, he's been here 30 years, that's long enough, and there's going to be this argument about, you know, it's time for a new generation of leadership in Kentucky, et cetera, et cetera. Could that be effective, you think?
Oh, sure. I mean, that's exactly it. I mean, Mitch McConnell would like to make the case that it's this election is about Barack Obama, and he's going to tie Alison Grimes to Obama at every opportunity, mm-hmm. whereas she will say that the issue is about Mitch McConnell, that, you know, 30 years in the Senate is enough, that it's time for new leadership. And if she could reach out to Republican women, which, of course, is part of the goal. And, you know, we assume that McConnell will get most, if not, you know, most of the Republican vote, most of the vote that Matt Bevin got on Tuesday. But there is the possibility that some Tea Party folks may just decide to sit home, that they, you know, they feel that McConnell is not much different than the Democrats. Of course, that's on the face of it, it's kind of ridiculous, because McConnell, if you talk to Democrats, they think of him as this, you know, this right-wing enemy. But if you talk to Tea Party folks, you find that Mitch McConnell is just too accommodating for them. So if a certain percentage of conservatives sit home and Grimes could reach across the aisle for Republican women, either way, this election is going to be very close.
How much, with this being, with Mitch McConnell having the possibility, if the Republicans would take control of the Senate, that he would be the majority leader, is there going to be more national money flooding, more money than flooding into Kentucky that can actually be spent on advertising for this race? Because McConnell has a pretty good war chest of his own without national money.
As does Grimes. So this will perhaps be one of the two or three most expensive races in the country. North Carolina is probably another one. Given the fact that, I mean, look, the Republicans need a pickup of 6 seats, a net gain of 6 seats. But they do know that both Kentucky and Georgia are considered close. Both states have female Democratic nominees who are running very centrist campaigns, very well-financed campaigns. And so while the Republicans are saying, we're going to win in South Dakota, we're going to win in West Virginia, we're going to knock off Begich in Alaska and Landrieu in Louisiana and Hagan in North Carolina, they know they have to defend states like Kentucky and Georgia, and tons of money will go into those two states.
We are talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin about this week's primary election results and all things politics. He also asked a question, and he said it was easier, but we haven't had the first call, yeah. So we'll repeat that coming up after the break. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. It's our monthly chat with political junkie Ken Rudin, and today we're reviewing primary election results from Tuesday and talking about other headlines. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. You'll also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100, and go ahead, Ken, and repeat your trivia question that was so easy that so far no one has called about.
Well, okay, the last Ohioan appointed to the U.S. Senate, and so who is that person, and whom did he replace?
Right.
And Howard has his answer written down. I'll give it another 20 minutes through the next break, okay. And if we don't have any guesses, we'll let Howard take a stab at it.
All right.
But I hate to tell you, though, Howard, since you work here, you cannot have a political junkie button.
Come on.
But you know what's so funny about this is that some of the questions I've given, I think, are so hard, and your audience gets the answer.
They get
answer.
How
do they know this stuff?
Right.
And these are not Google questions. I mean, these are stuff you just have to know or not know.
Right.
And your audience is pretty, even though your audience is still smart, they're still listening to the show for an hour, which I don't understand. But,
well, Kentucky, the Kentucky primary got a lot of attention, but there were primaries in five other states on Tuesday. Let's start and we've already kind of talked about it a little bit, but the primary in Georgia for the U.S. Senate seat, there is that seat will be open because there's a retirement. The Republicans, I believe, are in a runoff, and the Democratic candidate is somebody that's got pretty good name recognition.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We talk about these Bush family legacies and the Clinton family legacies. Well, nowhere is the legacies more apparent in Georgia on the Democratic side, both in the Senate race. Michelle Nunn is a Democratic nominee, and of course, she's the daughter of Sam Nunn, who was a senator for 24 years. Very conservative Democrat, a very popular guy who retired in 1996. And the candidate for governor is Jason Carter, who is the grandson of Reuben Hurricane. No, is the grandson of former President Jimmy Carter. So the Carter and Nunn names are big names, big draws for the Democrats. We'll see if the demographics are changing fast enough in Georgia to help them. But in the Senate race, it's a big race. This is the one where Saxby Chambliss, Howard, as you remember, Chambliss hit that home run against the Kansas City Royals.
Yeah, right.
No, that was Chris Chambliss.
Right.
I'm sorry. But Saxby Chambliss is retiring after two terms in the Senate. And the Republicans, the fear in the Republican Party and the hope in the Democratic Party was that the Republicans were running so far to the right in the primary that they would just scare away any centrist or independent voters in November. But the good news for the establishment is that the more extreme Tea Party folks, and those are Congressman Paul Brown and Phil Gingrich, they finished fourth and fifth in the primary. And so the runoff, the July 22nd runoff, is between David Perdue, who's his businessman, a cousin of a former governor, and Jack Kingston, who's a conservative but more of a moderate conservative, going into a July 22nd runoff. Now, the bad news for the Republican Party is that they're going to still beat each other up for two more months while Michelle Nunn can just coast, you know, and just, you know, keep raising money and not spending it. But ultimately, it's still a conservative state, even though the demographics are changing. More African-Americans, more Latinos are moving into the state, and that ultimately Georgia could become what Texas will likely become down the line, but down the line may not be 2014.
Well, these two Republicans, obviously, like you say, they're going to be beating each other up for the next few months. But Democrats, I mean, they were rooting for one of these Tea Party candidates, you know, to win this thing.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, obviously, you know, we talked about what the effect of the Tea Party is around the country, and we saw that, you know, we talked about Mitch McConnell in trouble and Georgia Republicans in trouble and John Cornyn in Texas in trouble. And ultimately, that's not what's happening. I mean, the Tea Party could still have play big roles. On June 3rd, there's a huge primary in Mississippi where Thad Cochran, who's been around since 1979, is facing a very strong conservative challenger in Chris McDaniel. And that race is really, really very close. But ultimately, what happened on Tuesday is that the establishment wing of the Republican Party did its homework, got the candidates they wanted, and you know, in these Republican leaning states, and certainly Kentucky and Georgia are considered Republican leaning, the Republicans got the candidates they want. But as you say, two more months of Republican infighting.
And I think it was on Morning Edition on Wednesday, there was a report that the analysis was that they were a little surprised that Sam Nunn has been kind of staying out of the spotlight in that race with his daughter involved. Do you look for that to change before November?
I'm not sure. You know, the last time Sam Nunn was on a ballot was 1990. And if memory serves, I think he ran unopposed. There was not much of a Republican Party opposition to him. So I don't know what the name Sam Nunn still means in Georgia. I know there are still some schools named after him. And I'm sure, you know, just like Cincinnati is filled with Howard Wilkinson signs, you know, Howard Wilkinson streets and everything like that. So I don't know if it's the same thing with Sam Nunn in Georgia, but ultimately she's going to have to run on her own. And even whether it's her father's influence or not, a lot of these polls, and again, the Republicans haven't focused on Michelle Nunn yet, but a lot of the polls show her doing very competitively, if not leading these Republicans. But things could change after July 22nd and the runoff.
And let's talk about Pennsylvania for a little bit. That the Democrat who won the primary, spent, you know, basically his own money to do this.
$10 million.
$10 million.
And I think we're talking about the race for governor.
Governor, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, the race for governor in Pennsylvania. That looks to me to be one where the Democrats have a chance of picking up a state house.
Well, first of all, I mean, Tom Corbett's governor of Pennsylvania, yeah, very unpopular. His numbers have been deadly for the longest time. Even among fellow Republicans, Tom Corbett's numbers have never been good. And he's clearly the most endangered governor of either party in the country. Now, what the hope was among the Republicans is that maybe the Democrats would have picked some liberal, some, you know, whatever. But Tom Wolf, not the author, of course, but is a businessman who never ran for office before. And what he did very smartly, he blanketed the airwaves months in advance when nobody ever heard of him. And I'm not a politician, I'm just a problem solver. I can get the job done. And he is probably the clearest. I thought from the beginning that he would be the strongest candidate in November for the Democrats. And, you know, Alison Schwartz, who was a congresswoman from Philadelphia, who was the earlier front runner until Tom Wolf started spending his money. Right. Republicans were hoping to run against her and run against the liberal Philadelphia Democrat stuff, but it doesn't work. Tom Wolf, it's still May, but it looks like he will knock off Corbett. And as you well remember, the last governor of Pennsylvania to lose was in 1854.
Hmm.
How's that for a trivia question? That's the Ohio trivia question.
Did you write about that race?
back in the day, yes. Yes. And matter of fact, what I pointed out that neither William Bigler, the Democrat who lost, or his Republican winner, neither one used television. And that's so weird.
That's odd. That's very odd.
Yeah, yeah.
We are talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we finally have some brave folks who are willing to take a stab at your trivia question. Go ahead and repeat the question one more time, Ken.
The last Ohioan appointed to the U.S. Senate, and whom did he or she replace?
And our first person that's going to take a stab at that is Howard N. Montgomery. Howard, go ahead.
Hello, Howard. This is Howard. Howard Mitchell. This is totally from memory, not from Googling. It was John Glenn. He was appointed by Dick Celeste after Howard and replaced Howard Metzenbaum after, which is ironic, because Metzenbaum beat John Glenn in the primary in 1970. Now, I hope I'm confidence.
You are not right.
No,
John Glenn was elected to the Senate in 1974. He did lose the primary in 1970, but he was elected on his own in 1974. He was not appointed to the Senate.
All right, Howard, we appreciate your guess. Let's try Bill, who is Bill from Union, Kentucky. Bill, go ahead.
Okay, well, that threw me for a curve, but how about Howard Metzenbaum, who was appointed to finish Saxby's term?
Ken?
Bill is the correct answer.
And Howard had it right.
Okay.
He wrote it right down.
Way to go, Bill.
I was kind of hoping that the first Howard would have it right, because Howard talking to Howard about Howard Metzenbaum. I mean, Howard, you like that? But no, Bill is exactly right.
Bill's the correct right.
When William Saxby was appointed Attorney General Nixon after the Watergate stuff, he left the Senate, and Governor Dick Celeste appointed Howard Metzenbaum, not John Glenn, but Howard Metzenbaum to the Senate, and of course Glenn beat Metzenbaum in the primary that year.
One correction, it was actually John Gilligan who appointed.
John Gilligan, yeah. Right.
And then Metzenbaum and Glenn faced off in the 1974 primary, and Glenn won and defeated Ralph Perk, and stayed in the Senate for a very long time. And 1976,
right?
Metzenbaum came back and challenged Robert Taft
Jr.
Yeah,
right.
And defeated him.
Right. How come we don't talk more about Ralph Perk?
I don't know. I knew Ralph Perk, and Ralph Perk.
He was a friend of yours?
Yeah, he was. Well, I wouldn't call him a friend, but he was an interesting guy.
Well, Bill, through all that, you will receive a political junkie button, and I tell you what, if you'll hold the line, they'll get your information. We'll get that out to you.
All righty. Thank you very much.
Ken, politician who sets his hair on fire with that torch is an interesting politician.
And also, I think Ralph Perk, who was the mayor of Cleveland at the time, was invited to see Richard Nixon at the White House, but he had to cancel because he said it was his wife's bowling night.
That's correct.
I love Ralph Perk stories.
Right.
I just love it when two old-timers can tell political stories, and I can say I was a baby and don't remember any of this.
Yeah, I was
or know any of these people.
Howard, remember when William Bigler lost in Pennsylvania in 1854? That was unbelievable.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
I was so wrong on that one.
Yeah. I think we all were.
Again, we're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin. If you have any comments or questions, 513-419-7100. Well, we talked about Kentucky, we've talked about Georgia, we've talked about Pennsylvania. Let's move out to Oregon, where the Oregon Senate race, and indirectly, that sort of evolved into a little bit about Obamacare because of the state's problems with its own health insurance exchange, where I think they essentially finally gave up and turned it over to the federal government. So what happened in Oregon?
Jay, just before you go to Oregon, one more thing about Pennsylvania. There was in the race to succeed Alison Schwartz in Pennsylvania's 13th district, there was a lot of attention on Marjorie Margolis, whose son, of course, is married to Chelsea Clinton. And so the Clintons, Bill and Hillary, did a last-minute endorsement and campaign on behalf of Marjorie Margolis, who held the seat for one term in the 1990s, but she got clobbered in that primary. So for all the talk about how important endorsements were, they weren't in that Pennsylvania race, so she lost that race. But back to Oregon, yeah, exactly right. The state healthcare system was really not working, had to turn it over to the federal government. And Monica Wiebe, who was this moderate conservative first-time candidate running on the Republican side, she is hoping, and she is now the nominee, to take on first-term Democrat Jeff Merkley, but the conservatives didn't like her. They thought she was too moderate, and the conservatives backed another candidate, but Wiebe won pretty handily. And the only thing I don't like about Oregon, and it's okay, I shouldn't really be opinionated, but Oregon has mail-only voting. Do you know that? You can only mail voting?
I think I remember that.
Why can't women vote in Oregon? I think that's not fair. I think it's a disgrace. I think something should be done about it. And when I'm governor of Pennsylvania, I will make sure that changes.
Are you working to be a stand-up comedian?
Wait, what else would you call this Cincinnati edition? I mean, this is exactly what we do.
Let's see. What about, I was looking, there were five things to watch on the primary from Tuesday that I took out of the USA Today, and one of those was about can Tea Party defeat veteran House members in Idaho? There was a primary in Idaho, so did the Tea Party defeat veteran House members in Idaho?
Not close. I mean, the congressman is Mike Simpson. He is a moderate. He's been targeted by the Tea Party for the longest time, and they made it clear from day one that they were going to have a challenge to Mike Simpson, and they did have a candidate who ran against him, but this guy, ultimately the Club for Growth said this guy is not going to win, and they walked away from the race. Same with Bill Schuster in Pennsylvania, a strong Tea Party target from the beginning. They put a lot of money into this guy named Art Halverson, and Halverson probably made it close. It was like 53-46. But the point is that all the incumbent members of Congress, Mike Simpson, Idaho, Bill Schuster, in Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, all survived. So you could say that the Tea Party suffered a huge defeat on Tuesday, or you could say that maybe the Tea Party challenge moved the Republican Party more to the right and got what they wanted ultimately. But both the Republicans who were challenged by the Tea Party all survived and handily.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's my question about it. You know, was it a Tea Party defeat, or did they make enough of an impression to move some of these more mainstream candidates in their direction? I mean, where do you think it's going?
Well, I mean, I think the debate, and the point is nobody's talking about Democrats anymore. And if they're talking about Democrats, they're talking about Veterans Affairs scandals and what did Hillary Clinton know in Benghazi. So it seems like the fact that the conversation is all about Republicans is good news for the Republican Party, unless it's just talking about how dysfunctional they are. But it's too soon to say what kind of effect they have. You know, people like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and Mike Lee in Utah, they all defeated or pushed aside establishment Republicans to win their seats, and they held it. But then, of course, you go back to the Murdochs and the Todd Akins of the and the Christine O'Donnells of the world and say, boy, they cost us serious opportunities to win seats in other states. So it's a mixed bag. I think they're not having a good year. I think the Republican establishment has been prepared. But to call Mitch McConnell a liberal or a rhino, you know, Republican in name only, or a moderate, is just wrong. And I think that was the problem with the Tea Party argument from the beginning.
What is Mississippi kind of the last stand for the Tea Party down there with Thad Cochran?
That's the last. I mean, there are other, of course, Lindsey Graham in South Carolina does have a primary battle, and which could very well go to a runoff. And if the Tea Party unites behind Graham's opponent, something could happen. But the Thad Cochran story is interesting because Thad Cochran has been around. He was in 1978, the first Republican elected to the Senate since Reconstruction. And he is you know, this sounds like a pejorative, but he is an appropriator. He likes to spend money. He's brought tons of money home to Mississippi. And while once upon a time, senators and members of and House members love to say, look how much I've done for the district, that's not what conservatives like. They feel that it's politics as usual. We have these huge debts and we're spending more and more money. And again, that, you know, the fact that Cochran's been around for so long. So the conservatives are backing this guy, Chris McDaniel, who's a state senator. First of all, they didn't think that Cochran was going to run again. And he surprised a lot of people when he said he would run again. And there's been a lot of weird things going on in Mississippi. You know, Ted Cochran's wife is in suffers from dementia and she's in a hospital. And then somebody, an opponent of Cochran, snuck into the hospital, took pictures of her and posted it on the internet, which is beyond the pale. And it's just weird stuff going on. But that's a race to watch June 3rd. That may be, I don't know if it's their last stand, but it's something they're very, very high on.
What we talked about the primaries this week. Earlier this month, there was a primary for the Senate in North Carolina. Fill us in on the North Carolina primary.
Well, that was another Tea Party argument. Now, this is interesting. The Republican frontrunner was a guy named Tom Tillis, who was the Speaker of the State House of Representatives. The state legislature in North Carolina is very, very conservative, perhaps the most conservative legislature in the state's history. They pass things restricting abortion and voting rights and all these things that, you know, it's on the conservatives' wish list. But they felt that because Karl Rove and Jeb Bush and other establishment people like Tom Tillis, the Tea Party came back to other candidates, a guy named Greg Brannon. And so Rand Paul came in and endorsed Greg Brannon and campaigned for him. What the Republicans were fearful of, which is what's happening in Georgia, is that Tom Tillis would be forced into a runoff and spend two more months fighting the Tea Party while their real target should be Kay Hagan, the Democratic incumbent. But Tom Tillis won 46% of the vote. In North Carolina, you need 40% to avoid a runoff. And so, again, considered a big victory for the establishment, Tom Tillis is no less than even money against Hagan in November.
Yeah. Our guest today is political junkie Ken Rudin, and, of course, that means we're talking politics. We'll continue our chat in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Political junkie Ken Rudin is joining us today, as he does once a month, to talk about political headlines. You can join the conversation. The number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Before we leave the primaries behind, there was one more five things to watch as the Tea Party faces a primary test. This was something that was in USA Today on Tuesday. Will any of the Senate Democratic nominees who win Tuesday campaign with President Obama?
Well, that's a great question, and certainly it's not going to happen in Kentucky. I think President Obama lost Kentucky twice. His numbers are awful in Kentucky. Perhaps maybe Mitch McConnell will invite President Obama to campaign for Allison Grimes, but that's not going to happen. Interesting in Georgia, I mean, the president only lost Georgia by 8 points. I suspect, though, that, again, as we saw, as I said earlier about Pennsylvania, and, you know, endorsements may not mean that much. Of course, President Obama will certainly be welcome to campaign in blue states. Like Oregon, which will be a tough race, and Colorado, but not in states that Mitt Romney carried in 2012.
What about Bill Clinton in Kentucky?
He's already campaigned for Allison Grimes. Bill Clinton and Allison Grimes' dad, Jerry Grimes, right, who used to be the chairman of the Democratic Party there. They're very close, and Bill Clinton also carried Kentucky twice. Right. There are some states where Obama will do well, but there are some states that Bill Clinton is the magic name. Kentucky is certainly one of them.
Let's talk about some other headlines. You mentioned it in passing in another answer, but the problems involving the Veterans Administration, and what does that mean politically? And who's it? I don't know if it's good for anybody, but who is it particularly bad for?
It's bad for the Democratic Party, and it's you know, once upon a time when we were talking about the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, and how Kathleen Sebelius, what her role would be, and whether she had to pay the price, Well, there was no rush on the White House part to get rid of her because the rules of the Senate would have caused a tough nomination fight to succeed her. But the point is, it was still months and months before the election. We're already in May, and the headlines on what's going on with the Veterans Administration is just awful. The thought about manipulating waiting lists and veterans who may have died waiting for care, and a possible cover up. Well, the thought that when President Obama came out yesterday and said, this is mad as hell, and everybody's mad as hell, but nothing is getting done. And I think this is something that the Democrats are really, really nervous about, because unlike the Affordable Care Act, which could be seen in political terms, what's going on with veterans is not cannot be seen. It's clearly that something is not working, that it's just a malfunctioning agency, and something has to be done. It was also Eric Shinseki, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, who said, who said that he was mad as hell. And John Stewart had this great line. He said that, Shinseki is not the kind of guy who gets very emotional. So John Stewart said, you saying you're mad as hell sounds like, the kind of thing you would say with, oh, we're out of orange juice. I mean, basically, he didn't have the kind of anger that a lot of people seem to be having what's going on in the Veterans Administration. And my suspicion is that Shinseki is not long for this job, because at some point, the political reality is going to have to take over.
And, this is a very large voting block when you're talking about veterans. And the older they get, the more they tend to vote Republican anyway. This could have a real big impact.
It is, because, it's part of the narrative. If you buy the Republican argument that that President Obama has been passive and not been involved and is late to the game, well, it's part of the narrative that he's just not a good administrator. And when you see months and months and months of stories of these, excessive wait times for veterans and the fact that the administrators covered it up and it reminds me of when George Bush talked about you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie, when he was talking about FEMA. Well, it seems like, President Obama still has not yet decided to say that it's Shinseki's fault, and whoever's fault it is, somebody has to take accountability. President Obama said yesterday that he's ultimately responsible for the misconduct of the VA, and well, of course he's ultimately responsible, but saying you're responsible and doing something about it and fixing systemic problems are just different things.
And is that going to require a new secretary?
I think it does. I think it does. Yeah. I mean, of course, he didn't say that, he didn't give him a ringing vote of confidence yesterday, but he still said he's standing behind him. But of course, he also said that there's going to be internal investigations. And, Shinseki may fall on his own sword and say, okay, it's time for me to go. But this is a serious political liability for the White House and the Democrats. And even Democrats are talking about it. There were two House Democrats from Georgia who said that Shinseki has to go. The American Legion also called for his resignation, although for the record, the Veterans of Foreign Wars has not. But it's just a conversation that the White House wishes was not taking place.
The I believe it was yesterday, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi announced she was going to appoint five Democrats to a House Select Committee, I believe is the term, to investigate the attack in Benghazi. I believe it was September of 2012. There was some thought that the Democrats may not even participate. What do you make of this Select Committee? Is it about getting information, or is it about rallying Republican voters, as has been charged by some?
Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the Republicans, they say there are a lot of unanswered questions. Of course, the Democrats will say these questions have been gone over and over again with a lot of congressional investigations. And I think Speaker John Boehner was willing to say, look, okay, we've been there, done that. We've already done this. But then when the White House, when some old email from the White House talking about talking points and how they should deal the political fallout to what happened in Benghazi in 2012 when four Americans, including the ambassador, were killed. Bain has said, wait a second, you know, they're obviously, the White House is obviously hiding something. The Democrats have said from the beginning, this is a political stunt. It's a circus. Many Democrats said, look, let's boycott this completely. But according to a lot of reports, Hillary Clinton, among others, say that by doing that, you give the Republicans, you know, the complete stage. They could play politics with all they want, and the Democrats won't have a say in it. So Nancy Pelosi decided that she'll name, you know, the five Democrats to the committee, with the seven Republicans. And the leading Democrat is Elijah Cummings, who's a congressman from Maryland, who has tangled with the Republicans before in Benghazi. He's not a rabid partisan, but he is not somebody who backs down at all easily. And so maybe for once and for all, you know, the answers will come out. Look, ultimately, I don't know what we're going to learn. Are we going to learn that the White House was very involved, interested in playing politics and trying to give a good political face to a tragedy that happened 2 months before the election? Probably. But I mean, is it any different than, you know, Colin Powell going to the UN and saying we have evidence of weapons of mass destruction when there was no evidence? I'm just saying that. I don't know if there's criminal activity going on here. It doesn't seem like it. It seems more about politics. And, you know, and the Democrats certainly know that Hillary Clinton is going to be a top target. She'll probably be called to testify. And although we've seen before that Hillary Clinton gives better than she takes, so perhaps the Democrats' worries are not that warranted. But for many, it's still a political circus.
Yeah. Last Friday night, I was at a Republican fundraiser here in Cincinnati, and their headline speaker was Rand Paul. And he spent, I would say, about half of his speech just ripping Hillary Clinton apart on Benghazi. He said that, you know, she was, because of her actions or inactions, was not fit to be commander-in-chief. He blamed her for, you know, not looking at the cables. He blamed her for not sending the security team over there. And, I mean, it was tough stuff. And it was clearly a campaign speech.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, the Republicans are convinced, as probably everybody is, that Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee for president in 2016. And it's funny, you know, a lot of Republicans had been saying good things about Hillary Clinton over the past couple of years. But I always thought that was just to point out how much disgust they have for Obama. And so in comparison, Hillary Clinton is a great leader and Obama was not. But now that Obama is not running again and Hillary Clinton is probably running again, she is the target of the Republican wrath. You know, we also saw the that Nigerian terrorist group that abducted those girls and those poor girls yeah. in Nigeria. Well, you know, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, this is the Republican claim now, that she refused to label the group a terrorist group. So once again, they're saying that she's naive about politics. Not naive about the problems in the world, which is ironic because if you talk to many people, or not many people, but some people on the progressive left, they feel that Hillary Clinton is too conservative, too establishment, too pro-Wall Street, too, you know, she's not bringing the change that so many people on the left want. So there's dissatisfaction. I don't know how serious it is, but with Hillary Clinton on both sides.
Story I took off the AP wire from Tuesday, the Michigan Attorney General's office is urging a judge to stay on the sidelines in the controversy over U.S. Representative John Conyers' reelection campaign. The Detroit Democrat has been barred from the August primary ballot because of problems with his petitions. What do you make of that situation? As somebody who's been in office since 1965, wouldn't you think he would know the process for being on the ballot?
This is one of the most remarkable stories I've ever seen, and it just baffles me. The guy, as you say, he was elected to Congress in '64. He is the longest-serving Black member of Congress in history. With John Dingell retiring this year, he would be the senior member of Congress. And what he did was, not only did he have people who were not non-registered voters gathering. Well, first of all, he had non-registered voters gathering petitions to get him on the August 5th primary ballot. That is against state law in Michigan. How somebody in Congress for that long did not know that is just remarkable. But not only were they non-registered voters, one of them apparently was a convicted felon, which is like just mind-boggling. And the thing is, he doesn't know what to do. Maybe he could run as a write-in, and that's a possibility as well. Maybe he can get another court to overturn what the Secretary of State's ruling is. But right now, it looks like somebody who's been in Congress for so many terms since 1965, you know, given so much of his career to serving in Congress, and the fact that he couldn't get 1,000 good signatures because he had the wrong people gathering them is just remarkable.
There was a New York representative who took to the House floor this week that indicated that unless the GOP does something on immigration reform, they risk becoming an extinct party. So does that push Republicans and the GOP to do something on immigration reform?
Well, no, because, I mean, the Democrats have been saying that for the longest time, and there may be some truth to that. They may be truth to saying that, look, you know, if the Republicans don't wake up now, they're going to turn around and see an America of a different color that the Republicans were just not prepared for. But at the same time, look, I think those are John Boehner's feelings, too. I think John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, really wants action on immigration overhaul, things like that. But, you know, we keep saying that we're close. It's going to happen soon. It's going to happen tomorrow. It's going to happen next week. And then ultimately we say, well, we're not ready for it yet. There's too much opposition among our members. The problem, and Jeb Bush has talked about this a lot, the problem is that for many House members who have very few minorities in their districts, it's not a crushing issue. It'll never be a crushing issue. But for others, they know that the country is changing. The demographics are changing. And if the Republicans don't pay attention to it, you know, once upon a time, the Republicans were the majority party in California. They were electing governors. They were electing more members of Congress. But ever since Pete Wilson ran for re-election in 1994 with his Proposition 187 against illegal immigrants, Latinos have been just running away from the Republican Party, and it's continuing to this day.
And it comes down to the fact that Boehner has a caucus where he has a whole lot of members who do not have to worry about this issue. As you say, they don't have that many Hispanic voters. And the voters they do have are clearly against what they call amnesty.
Exactly. And when members of Congress, when Republican members of Congress do talk about advancing immigration laws, they are hit with the A word, the amnesty word, right, and they could be hit with primary challenges. Now, theoretically, Boehner could bring this to the House, you know, later in the year when the deadline for primary candidates to file, to run, has passed. But right now, it keeps saying that, yes, we want it, it's going to happen, but it doesn't happen. And, of course, as we get closer and closer to November, it's less likely to happen.
It seems like almost every day or every other day there's a federal judge in a different state who is saying that a state's constitutional ban against same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. As that trend continues, does that have any political effect?
Well, it would if the Republicans made it an issue. They seem to be backing down from that issue. You know, in my Political Junkie podcast this week, in every episode I do it this day, this week in political history, and yesterday was the anniversary, the 22nd anniversary, when Dan Quayle attacked Murphy Brown for her family values and the fact that she was an unwed mother and wanted to have children and all these things. And Quayle tried to present the election, the 1992 election, as us against them, us, the family, God-fearing family, against them, the Hollywood elite liberals who want to upend family values. Well, fast forward to 2014, the majority view in this country is that same-sex marriage is a constitutional right. And, you know, in certain conservative states, in certain solid Republican states, sure, the Republicans could hang on to that issue, but it's one of those things that's definitely changing in this country.
We've been talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin. He joins us once a month to discuss politics. You'll find links to his website and the podcast he mentioned at WVXU.org. Ken, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, again, wvxu.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Bruce Ellis. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.